From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Oscar Wilde once wrote, "The first duty in life is to assume a pose. What the second is, no one has yet discovered." Tobias Wolff uses that quote to open his new memoir, This Boy's Life. On today's Fresh Air, Wolff talks about the poses he assumed and the lies he told as a child to create the person he wanted to be. Also today, we talk with John Flansburgh and John Linnell. Together, they make up They Might Be Giants, a rock band that's drawn its following from both the downtown Manhattan music scene and MTV. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles Johnny Otis, the R&B performer and club owner turned minister, and book critic John Leonard reviews a new biography of the late Paul Robeson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. So absolutely clear and hypnotic is Tobias Wolff's painful memoir of growing up in the 1950s that a reader wants to take it apart and find some simple way to describe why it works so beautifully. That's how Christopher Lehmann-Haupt began his New York Times review of Wolff's new book, This Boy's Life. Wolff's memoir is something of a companion piece to his brother Jeffrey's acclaimed book, The Duke of Deception, a portrait of their father who was a con man and fooled even his own children into believing he was from an aristocratic background. When Jeffrey and Tobias were children, their parents split up. Jeffrey lived with his father, Tobias with his mother. While Jeffrey was learning genteel skills and manners, how to shoot, how to read respectfully, how to box, and how to handle a boat, Tobias and his mother were virtually broke. Jeffrey's memoir is about discovering his father was a fraud. Tobias's memoir is about traveling west with a loving mother who wanted to make a new life but kept ending up with abusive men. Tobias Wolff won a 1985 Penn Faulkner Award for his short novel, The Barracks Thief. I wanted to know if Jeffrey's book, The Duke of Deception, inspired Tobias to write his new memoir.
Not really. In fact, my tendency was to avoid the idea of writing a memoir because he had written one originally. And I thought, well, you know, what's to be said here? But in fact, we had completely different lives. He grew up in the East. I grew up in the West. He grew up in rather privileged circumstances, and I did not. We grew up in different classes, really, and had lost touch with each other, in fact, for many, many years. So I had a completely different story to tell.
How did it come to be that you went with your mother and he went with your father when your parents separated?
Well, when our parents were divorced, we were each given a choice as to who to go with, and I was very young at the time, and it wasn't much of a choice anyway. I hardly knew my father, and I never did get to know him very well. But, of course, I stayed with my mother, and my brother was very attached to my father and went with him.
What was the experience like for you of reading your brother's book, The Duke of Deception, which really told about all the lies your father had created over the years, the fake history of himself that he had made up?
It was not a surprise, of course, because my brother and I are very close, and we have and I did indeed get to know my father later on in my life. We had talked about all these things before. I thought it was brilliantly written, a very moving book about his life with my father. It was a book mostly about my father. When I came to write my own memoir, it was. I have young boys, and what was beginning to interest me was just the whole question of growing up and how you make a self, how do you decide who you are, and that's what my book is about. It's really more about my own growing up, and it's my mother is a very strong figure in the book, as she was in my life and is in my life. But the concentration of my book is on this process of growing up.
Let me ask you to read the very beginning of your new memoir, This Boy's Life.
Good. Our car boiled over again just after my mother and I crossed the Continental Divide. While we were waiting for it to cool, we heard, from somewhere above us, the bawling of an air horn. The sound got louder, and then a big truck came around the corner and shot past us into the next curve, its trailer shimmying wildly. We stared after it. "Oh, Toby," my mother said. "He's lost his brakes." The sound of the horn grew distant, and faded in the wind that sighed in the trees all around us. By the time we got there, quite a few people were standing along the cliff where the truck went over. It had smashed through the guardrails and fallen hundreds of feet through empty space to the river below, where it lay on its back among the boulders. It looked pitifully small. A stream of thick black smoke rose from the cab, feathering out in the wind. My mother asked whether anyone had gone to report the accident. Someone had. We stood with the others at the cliff's edge. Nobody spoke. My mother put her arm around my shoulder. For the rest of the day, she kept looking over at me, touching me, brushing back my hair. I saw that the time was right to make a play for souvenirs. I knew she had no money for them, and I had tried not to ask, but now that her guard was down, I couldn't help myself. When we pulled out of Grand Junction, I owned a beaded Indian belt, beaded moccasins, and a bronze horse with a removable, tooled leather saddle. It was 1955, and we were driving from Florida to Utah to get away from a man my mother was afraid of and to get rich on uranium. We were going to change our luck.
One of the things I really like about that beginning is the sense of disaster can happen at any second. A trunk could just lose its brakes and go over the cliff. And your mother's going to try to be a good mother, and you're going to be a kid. I mean, it's just out of control. You're a kid. You're going to manipulate her to get that souvenir.
That's right. Yeah. It's an emblem of the book, in a way, that episode. We still talk about that episode. It made such an indelible impression on us. But
why? Why did it?
Well, we were so full of hope and going to this new life, and just for a moment there, we were too foolish for our optimism ever to get dampened for long, but just for a moment there, we tasted it, you know. We tasted our mortality, and we tasted the vanity of our hopes, seeing this man who probably was very hopeful himself about getting home for dinner that night, finishing his run, suddenly have everything go wrong on him. And I've never forgotten it. I can still see his face in the windshield.
You talked about how this memoir for you is really about coming of age, finding out who you are, who you want to be, and trying to become that. Your father transformed himself through lying, through making up a false history, through making up lineage that he didn't have, through even lying about his furniture and where that came from, making things into antiques that weren't.
Right.
Your mother wanted to transform herself and wanted to change her luck, but the way she ended up actually taking action was to hook up with different men.
Yes.
And all of those men ended up being disasters. They abused both your mother and you. And she seemed to really be unaware that that was going to happen each time she'd meet a new man. But you seemed to always know.
No, I didn't always know this was going to happen until it happened. I in a sense conspired in this by not learning my lesson either. We went from one man like this to another. It's true. But I think that what's more important than this is what we made of these situations. I mean, it's true that we drifted into these rather violent and frightening situations sometimes together, but we always kept faith with each other, and we kept our pluck, and we changed our luck again and again. We reinvented the circumstances. We'd go somewhere else and try again, and eventually, oddly enough, we were right. It worked. We both translated ourselves to different people and to better lives.
When you were young and you were in the Boy Scouts, you'd like to really read the Boy Scouts magazine, Boy's Life.
Mm-hmm.
Why did that really appeal to you? Your life was very different from the kind of mainstream view of what a Boy Scout should be, the good and healthy, wholesome life.
Yeah, that's right. I think that when I was reading it, I fell into a kind of spell in which I believed I was those boys that the magazine was about, these boys who saved lives and had trap lines in the Arctic, and boys who built airplanes in their backyards and flew them at state fairs, these extraordinary young entrepreneurs. And while I was reading this magazine, I felt like I was participating in this ideal American boyhood that all the movies I went to and the television shows and the radio shows that I listened to sort of invited us all to believe we were living. And there's a strange disjunction that happens with children in this country between the ideal childhood that's proposed to them. We're a culture that has a kind of worship of children and childhood, and yet people don't really live those lives. And so they look at them from a distance with kind of worshipful eyes and pretend they're living them. So that magazine was very, very important to me in that way when I was young. That's why I called this memoir of mine, This Boy's Life. It's to distinguish between that ideal boyhood of Norman Rockwell, the kind of pictures that Norman Rockwell would draw of young of childhood, and the kind that I and in fact most of the boys I knew when I was growing up actually lived.
You really wanted to have a conventional life and a conventional family.
Sure. I think it's a real cycle. I think that children who grow up in safe, secure, conventional, middle-class families all want to become outlaws and rebels and live in dirty apartments and never do the dishes. And children who grow up chaotically and in poverty and who have no automatic hold on respectability in the world come to prize conventionality and security. Yes, that's what I wanted when I don't want it so much anymore, I think, but I sure did want it when I was a boy.
Your mother wanted a good family that spent time together also, and I really like what you write about that. You say, Mother insisted we spend time together like a real family. Our failure was ordained because the real family we set out to imitate doesn't exist in nature. A real family as troubled as ours would never dream of spending time together.
That's right. Yeah, I'd forgotten that line. That's right.
But how much of that charade did you go through?
Well, we had our rich. This was the life I led with my first stepfather and his family, and that we led with them. And we did. We had these rituals of family life, and they were they gave us for a little while the appearance, and we actually probably believed that we were a real family when we would sit together and watch Lawrence Welk. I can't hear the name today without wilting. Mitch something in the sing-along
Mitch
gang.
Mitch Miller.
He used to make us watch Mitch Miller. We'd all sit around. That was our idea of a family evening, is sitting in front of the tube and watching Lawrence Welk and Mitch Miller. And my stepfather would get his old saxophone out and sit there and oh, Lord. Don't make me relive it again.
I don't know. You've just been through it in your book, although you left out that particular story.
The Mitch Miller one I left out, but I've got Lawrence Welk in there all right.
Tobias Wolff is my guest, and his new memoir is called This Boy's Life. There's a scene that you describe, one of the father figures in your life, one of the men that your mother had hooked up with for a while, gave you a Winchester, a rifle. And one day you were leaning out the window, aiming the rifle out the window, pointing at a couple who were walking by. And you pulled the trigger and actually didn't shoot the couple, you shot a squirrel. But in describing that scene, in reading that scene, I couldn't help but wonder whether, looking back, you think you were ever on the verge of really becoming one of those neighbors next door who goes nuts and kills somebody?
Well, in a way, I guess the point of that scene is that anybody can become someone like that almost inadvertently. It's funny, my friends, when they've read that section, the men, not the women, have almost all said to me, I was not aiming the rifle at these people when I pulled the trigger. I was aiming at something else. But it is true that I used to aim the rifle out the window at people walking past. And every boy I know who grew up in a house where there were weapons did things like that. They've all told me that. It is a very typical thing. What do you think kids do with those things? They watch when the things we watch in the movies and TV kind of take away our sense of mortality, that, you know, that things don't have consequences when you point guns at people. There, you'll see them next week on another show. And we have an infatuation in this country with firearms and handling them. And boys left alone in a house, I think girls are not so interested in them, but boys left alone in a house with a weapon are going to get that weapon out and they're going to point it.
Your memoir, This Boy's Life, is about how you invented and reinvented yourself. And perhaps the most stunning reinvention of yourself that you're responsible for is how you got into prep school. Just to explain here, although your father had for a while been rich, your mother, who you were with, was always poor. And when you were in, I guess it was junior high school, you and your brother started communicating, and your brother urged you to try to get away from your father, who was your stepfather, who was beating you, and try to get into prep school, and he said he'd try to help you. So you got really hooked on the idea and tried to get a scholarship. So what you did was you made up letters of recommendations from all of your teachers, and you tried to really write it in their tone of voice. And you wrote, "And on the boy who lived in their letters, the splendid phantom who carried all my hopes, it seemed to me at last I saw my own face." And I thought that's so convincing that you were really, truly writing letters about the boy who you think you were or deserved to be as a boy, as opposed to the boy who you were forced to become.
Right. Yeah. Well, we all have a kind of dream self. And in making and in writing those, my actual self, I'm afraid, wasn't quite the boy that I portrayed in those letters. I was a very indifferent student in a very bad school, and lazy, and I didn't even go to school a lot of the time. I hung out with a bad bunch, and I mean, they were actually good guys, really, looking back on it, but they were a, they were considered a bad bunch then, and I was no model of American boyhood, and to get into this, to get not just to get in, I had to get a scholarship to this prep school, and it was quite clear to me that being the boy I was, in fact, was not going to get me in. I couldn't even get a letter of recommendation from my teachers, so I decided to take this task on myself. What did I have to lose, right? I'd end up, if I lost, being where I was. So I basically wrote down in these letters of recommendation that I made up a picture of the boy that I dreamed I really was if everybody just knew me actually, as well as I knew myself. And you know, the straight-A student, the Eagle Scout, upright fellow, and manufactured this identity and did it, I guess, persuasively enough, since I did get it, a scholarship to a fine prep school, which changed my life completely.
Did you do a convincing job of reinventing yourself at prep school because you had to pretend to be the boy who you had described in these letters, the boy who got you into this school?
No, it didn't hold up very well. For one thing, coming from such a lousy school as I was coming from, and not having been a good student at that school anyway, I didn't know very much. I was very ignorant, and my teachers were puzzled at how little I knew considering the brilliant transcripts that came in. I had a friend in the school office at that school who gave me the school transcript form, so I made out my own grades, and I awarded myself straight A's and in courses that I hadn't even taken in order to get in. So I didn't know very much. I had a terrible time academically at the school, but an English teacher there took me under his wing and tutored me and gave me books, and I was excited about reading anyway, but he taught me to be a systematic and careful reader, and he excited me about writing, as indeed my brother had also, and really brought me along. It was the pivotal experience of my life being at that school and being under that man's tutelage. And I owe, you know, just all kinds of things to him for that. So it turned out to be a wonderful, almost fairy tale escape for me. And I loved the school, but no, the act didn't hold up. And eventually it fell apart, and I was in my senior year there, in my last year, my sixth form year, I was asked to leave.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your life and about your writing, but first we'll take a very short break. My guest is Tobias Wolff. His new memoir is called This Boy's Life. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Tobias Wolff, we were just talking about how you lied your way into prep school but eventually got thrown out. Do you believe in lying when it's the only way to get what you need and when you know that ultimately you're not telling a terrible mistruth, that it won't be a malicious mistruth?
Well, on the one hand, as a writer, I'm committed to truth. I mean, in this book about a boy who lies, I am very scrupulous in telling the truth, and the book is in a lot of ways about the cost of not telling the truth. So no, ultimately I think lies subtract from your substance as a person, and The more of them you tell, the more you beggar yourself. But I will distinguish between lying and invention, and especially self-invention. Children need to try on different selves. They don't know who they are. They try different things. You'll see the way kids change their hair constantly, you know, their hairdos, and experiment with their clothes and all that. It's really all sort of fumbling around trying to figure out who they are. And so there's a period when you're young when I think especially parents have to be very careful not to apply standards about lying to what is naturally occurring in the child's life in terms of just figuring out who they are and trying on different selves. And sometimes that involves acts of self-invention. And I think that, you know, that we have to be very tolerant about that.
Even when you're trying very hard to tell the truth, there are so many different versions of the truth. Did you run into that when writing this memoir? I think you gave the manuscript to your mother and to your brother and to others to read before
it
was published.
Absolutely. Yeah, I wanted to be sure that when it came out, they wouldn't say, oh, no, this is, not to others, but to me, you've got it all wrong. And I was very gratified that they were very impressed by the accuracy of the record and that it really squared with their own recollections. My mother had some questions about chronology. She has a wonderful kind of memory, and she says here and there I got things switched around and whatnot, but nothing serious at all. And basically I let those things stand because that's the way I remembered them, and that's the story I'm telling is what my memory tells me. You can follow someone around with a camera and a notebook and a tape recorder, and you'll get a lot of facts, but you won't get the truth. The truth lies in the memory, and because that's the story you tell yourself about who you are and where you come from, where you've been. And so I was very attentive to my memory and trusted that.
You and your brother have both written memoirs about your childhood. You've read each other's books, and you've become very close over the years, even though you were separated from each other during childhood.
Maybe that's why we're close.
Did you ever go through a period of envying each other's lives? Did you ever wish you'd stayed with your father? Did your father ever wish he'd stayed with your mother? Did he ever wish he was poor, like you were often poor? Did you ever wish that you had money like he did?
I can't speak for him. I don't think that he ever wished to be poor. I don't think anybody ever wished to be poor. But I certainly spent a lot of time wishing I was rich. And my father was a very charismatic guy. Though I hardly knew him, I remembered him well. I could remember the sort of tobacco smell that used to cling to his tweeds. He had a deep, grumbling voice, and he was big and had a very bearish kind of presence. And I remember lying in my bed at night and hearing his voice come through the bedroom wall, that rumble of his, and I'd how secure I'd feel hearing that. So there were, you know, I longed to be with my father, not to be with my mother, but to be with my father also. And I romanticized him and idealized him to an extraordinary degree, as you do with an absent parent. When the parent is there and you can, and you experience the humanity of that and the flaws and natural difficulty of living with another person from day to day, you can't do that. But children who are separated for years and years from their parents without seeing them, oddly enough, develop very, very idealized notions of them, and I certainly did with my father.
We were talking about lies before. What was the most damaging lie that your father told you?
It wasn't so much lies he told me, but truths that he did not tell me. I was led to believe by him that we came from an aristocratic family, and that he had coats of arms and all this. And my mother was Irish Catholic. I was brought up in the Catholic Church, and he objected to this. He said his family had always been Episcopalians and everything. Well, it turned out my father's family were a wonderful Jewish family of doctors and brilliant surgeons with their own claim to respect and stature, which he and some he didn't want to be Jewish, and he cut my brother and I off not only from that knowledge but from the knowledge of that of his wonderful family because he didn't want us to understand this about him and consequently about ourselves. And so we lost that half of our family, when my brother went back to write about my father and interviewed these people, they were wonderful people. And it broke our hearts that we had been denied their company when we were growing up, and the richness of that life that they had in Hartford. So, you know, his lies had terrible, terrible consequences on us, as his absence did on me. That's partly what this book is about. I don't romanticize lying in this book. I talk about self-invention. I talk about lies, and the lies, you know, the big lies in this book cause inestimable harm.
You said earlier that when you were young, you really wanted a conventional family, but you implied you don't really feel exactly that way now.
Well, in some ways I do. I mean, but
I should say here that I think you're married and have two children.
Oh
right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I think what it is that kind of hankering for respectability that children have who feel that in some way or other they aren't respectable. And no, that's what I was talking about. I mean, I just don't go around worrying about that very much anymore. I don't care all that much anymore what people think of me. I do care a lot about what they think of my work, I'm less vulnerable to the opinion of others than I was when I was a boy.
This is, I believe, the first really autobiographical thing that you've written. You've written stories about other people, and they are indirectly autobiographical. But this is direct autobiography.
Yes,
do you feel exposed by it? What's the experience been for you?
Yes, I do. In the past, when people are, as I say, the way we're talking right now, if I'm being interviewed about a collection of stories or a novel that I've written, people will talk about the characters, and it's quite clear these are characters, these are inventions, even though obviously they may spring from some origin in my life. We're talking about figures in a book. And now when we're talking about this book, you know, clearly we're talking about me, or at least my idea of who I am and the people I've known. And yes, I do feel vulnerable. I think I'd be crazy if I didn't.
But is that an acceptable feeling to you? I mean, will you continue to write directly about yourself?
Probably not, but not because I'm afraid of that feeling. No, this wasn't the first installment in a series of memoirs, such as, say, Jimmy Carter might write about the landscape of his life and the great figures he's known and the Camp David Accords. I mean, it's not like that. I just found something. I've always thought that that those events that I recount in this book had a very interesting, almost novelistic shape to them, and have been wanting to write the story for years about growing up. It's really about the experience of growing up in this country, being kind of outside the circle of privilege, but wanting in badly, and what you'll do to get there.
One last thing. Do you think that your writing changed at all, that the voice you used was different because you were writing in first person?
Yes. Yes, it was different. It's a little fuller. I tend to have I think it's a warmer voice. It tends to be I tended to really pull out the stops when I wrote this. I just imagined talking to a great friend, you know, when I was writing this book, and let it rip.
You're going to do that the next time you write something? Imagine that you're talking to a great friend?
Yes, probably so. I enjoy using the voice in this, and I don't know what I'm writing stories again now, and I don't know what they're going to be like in the end.
Okay, well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Good talking to you.
My guest has been Tobias Wolff, and his new book, This Boy's Life, is a memoir about his childhood. It's just been published by the Atlantic Monthly Press. Wolff won the Penn Faulkner Award for his novel, The Barracks Thief. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with exiled Salvadoran poet Claribel Alegria. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. There are 37 songs featured on the first two albums by They Might Be Giants, but a couple of hundred other songs that they've written have been showcased on their answering machine. Coming up, we call up Dial-A-Song and check in with the founders of the band, John Linnell and John Flansburgh. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles Reverend Johnny Otis, a fixture on the R&B scene ever since World War II. And book critic John Leonard reviews Martin Bommel Duberman's new biography of singer and political activist Paul Robeson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. The Senate late today voted unanimously to confirm three more cabinet nominees. Samuel Skinner, Illinois transit executive and former federal prosecutor, will head the Department of Transportation. Longtime presidential friend Robert Mosbacher becomes Secretary of Commerce. And Carla Hills, who served as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development in the Ford administration, takes over as U.S. Trade Representative. Meanwhile, opponents of John Towers' nomination to become defense secretary testified today before the Senate Armed Services Committee. Some questioned his moral fitness for the job. NPR's David Mulpus has details.
Conservative activist Paul Weyrich said his reservations about Towers' moral character are based in part on his personal observations of the former Texas senator.
Over the course of many years, I have encountered the nominee in a condition lack of sobriety, as well as with women to whom he was not married.
Weyrich also said he had been told that the Bush transition team had received letters detailing specific allegations of moral impropriety by Tower, but Weyrich conceded he hadn't actually seen the letters. Committee Chairman Sam Nunn expressed irritation at charges made on secondhand testimony and said he would pursue the issue in closed session. After that session, two Republican senators emerged saying they heard nothing persuasive, that all Weyrich had to offer was hearsay. Two other critics testified against Tower on policy grounds, including William Jackson of the University of Arkansas, who said Tower symbolizes all that is wrong with the defense establishment. I'm David Malpas in Washington.
Senate Finance Committee Chairman Lloyd Benson said today the White House has asked for an indefinite delay in the confirmation hearing of Dr. Louis Sullivan as Secretary of Health and Human Services. A White House official said the delay was not a result of controversy surrounding Sullivan's position on abortion, but was to give more time for completion of paperwork. President Bush flew by helicopter to Norfolk today to give a speech on the deck of the aircraft carrier USS America. About 4,000 sailors, Marines, and shipyard workers gathered to hear the new commander-in-chief, as NPR's Jim Angle reports.
President Bush struggled through a case of laryngitis to tell the largely military audience that he commends their sacrifice and sense of duty. Then he told them he plans to hold defense contractors to the same standard. He said most defense contractors care about their work, but he added, "I am determined to make sure that every single one of them does." The president went on to say that he wants to expand the national consensus that he is needed for proper support of the nation's defenses.
I firmly believe that the vital first step to broadening our national consensus on defense is to wring the last drop of waste and mismanagement out of the way we buy our weapons, and that's what we intend to do.
The president, who coughed several times during his brief remarks, was asked later how he feels. He acknowledged having a little trouble getting through his remarks, but said he was just croaking along. I'm Jim Angle in Washington.
For his first overseas trip as Secretary of State, James Baker plans to go to Europe for a meeting with NATO foreign ministers, his counterparts. The State Department today said Baker's European trip is tentatively set for mid-February. At least 17 people were killed today in the crash of a military refueling jet near Abilene, Texas. Officials at Dyess Air Force Base say the plane went down in flames just after takeoff. The KC-135 jet carried 19 people and was en route from Dyess to Hickam Air Force Base, Hawaii, on a training mission. There's no word yet on the cause of that crash. Stock prices were higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 18 points to close at 2342.32. Advances led declines nearly 2-1 on volume of 195 million shares. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Reverend Johnny Otis has been called the godfather of rhythm and blues. He's been a seminal figure in the Los Angeles music scene as a performer, club owner, and preacher for almost 50 years. Otis has worked with or discovered a long list of artists, including Eddie Cleanhead Vincent, Esther Phillips, Linda Hopkins, and Big Joe Turner. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has met the man and has this profile.
One of the biggest kicks I got researching the book Rock of Ages came on February 20th, 1985, when I drove to a church in Los Angeles to interview its pastor. This was no ordinary minister, as I discovered. His study was crammed with oil paintings of great moments in Los Angeles black music history, and he had a couple of cockatoos with a real bad habit of saying dirty words at the kindly old women who came in to clean. But then, I wasn't expecting piety. This was the Reverend Johnny Otis I'd come to see, and the church was just the latest stop on a journey that had begun 50 years earlier. Although in his autobiography, Otis claims to have become black, he was born John Veliotis to a couple of Greek Americans who owned a small grocery in the largely black Berkeley flatlands. Johnny went to school with black kids, and they accepted him, especially when he took up the drums and turned out to have talent. Before he'd even graduated, he was in demand to play with all sorts of performers, and as soon as he could, he formed a regular band and began to tour. When World War II hit, Otis was fortunate to find himself in L.A., leading a versatile nine-piece band that was much in demand to back up the various singers and instrumentalists the clubs along Central Avenue and Avalon were featuring. In 1948, Johnny and his two friends Bardu and Tina Ali saw a trend emerging in post-war L.A. and invested in an old brewery building in a Mexican-American neighborhood called Watts. There they opened the Barrel House, a blues club for the blacks Otis and the Alis were certain would be moving there. It was a brilliant idea, as was Talent Night, when hopefuls could audition for a spot performing there and, perhaps, a recording contract. There's an underground telegraph, he told me, and everyone from Mississippi to Maine knew that Los Angeles is where you go to get yourself recorded. Right off the bat, he discovered a winner.
Been looking for you, Daddy. I just found you in time. You hit some other woman, and you swore that you were mine. What's the matter, Daddy? Don't my kisses satisfy? If I don't thrill you, baby, goodness knows what I've tried.
Esther Phillips was 14 when she won the Talent Night show and went on to record Double Crossin' Blues, the second largest selling rhythm and blues record of 1950. The backup was by the Robins, who later became the Coasters, yet another Otis discovery. And thanks to his connections with KGFJ's top DJ, Hunter Hancock, another white man in a black music world, it was no problem to get airplay. When Otis wasn't touring or seeking out talent, he was looking for songwriters, which is how he found a couple of kids who worked in a record store on Fairfax Avenue, blues fanatics both. He needed a song for Big Mama Thornton, a singer he'd found on his last tour, and they obliged.
You!
Hound Dog proved to be a valuable copyright for Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, and a valuable lesson in the music business when they had to sue Johnny Otis to get his name off the writing credits. By 1953, when that record came out, though, Otis had lost the Barrel House, and was spending a lot of time on the road, crisscrossing the country and acting as talent scout for Don Robey's Peacock Records in Houston. He discovered young Etta James in the Fillmore Auditorium in San Francisco, and, as a favor to Robey, he cut some tracks with a young blues singer who'd gotten Robey so mad he'd beaten him up one night. Otis's vibes playing didn't mesh well with Little Richard Penniman's piano playing, and the records were never released. Eventually, Johnny Otis retired to Los Angeles, where he played the blues circuit with a review made up of some of the best of his alumni, like Little Lester and Pee Wee Creighton, and other L.A. masters who'd been temporarily forgotten, like Big Joe Turner and Roy Brown. He's never been particularly modest about his achievements, but then again, why should he be? Nowadays, people come from all over to visit his church, simply because with Johnny Otis at the pulpit, you never know who'll show up in the choir.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle.
All night long, all night long.
This is Fresh Air. They Might Be Giants is a New York-based rock band that got its start playing in the clubs and performance spaces of downtown Manhattan. But it's the exposure on MTV that's bringing in the preteen crowds to the duo's out-of-town concerts. Music critic Peter Watrous described their performances as having an overlay of humor masking deep thinking. They Might Be Giants is John Flansburgh on guitar and vocals, and John Linnell on vocals, saxophones, accordion, banjo, and other instruments. Their first album, They Might Be Giants, included 19 songs. Their new album, Lincoln, has 18 songs on it, but they've written hundreds of other songs that haven't made it onto record. They figured out another way of getting them out to the public.
Canary in the alley by the light switch. He watches over you. Make a little birdhouse in your soul, not to put you fine upon on it. Stay on the only beam you're bonnet. Make a little birdhouse in your soul.
Tell me why you started Dial a Song.
Well, it was before we were making records, so we were really thinking in terms of just the audience, the small New York audience that we had. And John actually broke his wrist, and I had a lot of stuff stolen in the same week, and so all of a sudden there was this, we knew we weren't going to be able to perform live for a few months at least, and we had all these songs that we really wanted to get out to the public. So in order to hold on to those 35 people who were truly interested in what we were doing, we figured we'd start the Dial Song service, which basically it's just a phone machine in my house. We don't really make any money off it or anything. It's just a different song every day, and now it's been going for like 4 years, so it's a raging success.
You've gone from being a pretty fringy band to now being prominently featured on MTV. What changed? Did something change in your music, or is it just that more people started to notice it?
We're just prominently fringy. we basically make the same, you know, the exact same kind of music that we've always made.
I think if you listen to the records, the records haven't really... The second record isn't radically different from the first record.
In fact, it's a big disappointment that we haven't advanced more.
We haven't sold out any more than we could have.
I think we've just we've been lucky because we got a lot of exposure from MTV, which is really the only national media that we could get to. I mean, we're not played on commercial radio by and large, so you just realize the power of national media.
The song that's getting the most airplay on MTV is Anna Ng. You want to say anything about writing that song?
Well, it's basically a sort of connect the dots kind of song that started with the Manhattan phone book. And I noticed one day that there's something like 3 pages of people named NG in the phone book. And I called up some of them to find out how it was pronounced and started kind of winding a song around that idea. And then basically the idea of the guy shooting the gun through the globe came from a Pogo comic strip where one of the characters does that to find out what the other side of the world is, which point is exactly opposite the Okefenokee Swamp.
Make a hole with a gun perpendicular to the name of this town in a desktop globe. Exit wound in a foreign nation, showing the home of the one this was written for. My apartment looks upside down from there. Water spirals the wrong way out the sink. And her voice is a backwards record. It's like a whirlpool and it never ends. Anna Ng and I are getting old and we still haven't walked in the glow of each other's majestic presence. Listen, Anna, hear my words. They're the ones you would think I would say if there wasn't me for you. All alone.
Now, there's only the two of you, and John Linnell, you play accordion and lots of instruments, and John Flansburgh, you play guitar. And what you do frequently is do an arrangement on tape and then bring the tape with you as a backup track for when you record in concert.
Yeah, that's invariably what we do when we perform live. I mean, that's our live show. So, and it's something that puts people off when they hear about it, but it really isn't as boring as it sounds.
Yeah. I think people sort of go into a coma when they hear that. That you have a track show. I mean, either they're thinking of some Vicky Sue Robinson lip sync concert that they saw in 1978, or some English band with really hard to imagine hair, doing some song where they're playing instruments on stage and the same sounds are coming out of the PA, but it's not the appropriate moves. The drummer is spinning at the same time that they're doing a drum roll. So, basically we're not trying to fake anybody out. It's a very direct, very non-illusionistic kind of use of tape. But, the show has got, it ranges from just simple accompaniment, like one voice, one instrument, to the tape, doing some raging, rock drum thing. And then, really distorted guitars and accordion and lots of both of us screaming our heads off. So it really, there's a real broad dynamic quality to the show.
You're also one of the few rock bands I can think of that's doing novelty songs. And one of the songs that comes to mind is Shoehorn with Teeth, which has, kind of absurd lyrics and I think a terrific arrangement. But it really is a novelty song.
Well, you should see us wincing here when you say the words novelty song.
Well, this is coming from someone who really likes novelty songs.
Yeah, you really hurt my feelings when you said that.
I think if this were 40 years ago or maybe we're on a different planet, we wouldn't be so uncomfortable with the idea of novelty song. But it's come to mean something fairly trivial. And I think our songs are novel. There's no doubt about it. It's, in other words, a novelty song conjures up the idea of a sort of a fairly facile joke that gets kind of laid out in the course of a few choruses. Whereas I don't think Shoehorn with Teeth is a very explicable song. It's a funny song, but it's hard to explain what it's about.
He wants a shoehorn, the kind with teeth. People should get beat up for stating their beliefs. He wants a shoehorn, the kind with teeth. 'Cause he knows there's no such thing. He asks a girl if they can both sit in a chair, but he doesn't get nervous. She's not really there. He wants a shoehorn, the kind with teeth.
A lot of the music that you both play is bathed in irony, and I was...
Dipped in irony.
Excuse me.
My goodness.
And I was wondering why you're so comfortable with with irony. And if there were rock poses that you think rock bands are supposed to take that you just really can't get serious
because
about.
Because we're snarling, angry people.
Yeah, I think we probably, you know, would like to shake off some of the irony in our songs, if, you know, if it were possible to be at least perceived as being more sincere. Because a lot of the stuff that we do, I think, has the form of irony. In fact, is trying to be serious and trying mm-hmm. to be sincere.
Give me an example.
Never mind.
Well, I think, for example, the thing about Shoehorn with Teeth is it sounds like there's some kind of joke going on. And in fact, it's just a set of words that, you know, came to mind. And it's not really, in other words, it's not a trying to annihilate something or be a parody of something.
Yeah, I think a lot of people misconstrue, especially the musical forms of what we're doing. They think we're somehow, making a commentary on the kind of musical forms that we use. When in fact, you know, I think, I mean, just the idea of playing music that you don't like, if you don't like country and western, you don't want to dedicate your life towards like making fun of it. And that's, I think, you know, we have songs that have, you know, country and western tinges to them, and it's because we like that kind of music and it speaks to us.
I never saw the movie They Might Be Giants, but I assume you named your group after
mm-hmm,
the movie.
Yeah.
How come you named your group that?
Well, we really liked the name, and I wouldn't want to say anything about the movie beyond that. That, in other words, it wasn't the movie itself that made us decide to name them ourselves They Might Be Giants, because it's really not... the movie doesn't really have much to do with the band.
It just seemed like a good paranoid name, you know?
It's yeah. Like, it's basically the name of the band is applies to... In other words, they in the name represents something external. It's not us, which unfortunately is not the impression a lot of people have gotten.
So does everybody get the name of your band wrong who doesn't know the movie? Like maybe they're giants or maybe they may be giants or...
Ain't they gods? Yeah. Yeah, somebody called up the record company and said, do you have Ain't They Gods?
Okay, thanks to both of you, John and John.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, Terry.
John Flansburgh and John Linnell. Their new album, Lincoln, is on Bar None Records. And you can reach Dial-A-Song by calling area code 718-387-6962.
Shoehorn, the kind with teeth, 'cause he knows there's no such thing.
This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a rundown of what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, how are you covering the opening of Oliver North's trial?
Well, we'll have a report from NPR's legal affairs correspondent, Nina Totenberg, about jury selection. You know, this is a very unusual jury selection because the judge is going to have to find regulars and alternate jurors who are, in his words, uninformed, people who didn't follow the Iran-Contra hearings. We'll report on what happened in the courtroom, but we also went out to the streets of Washington, D.C., which is where the trial is, to try to find uninformed people, to see how many there are who could be jurors in Iran-Contra. Also, a report about tensions between ethnic Germans and Italians in the Italian Tyrol.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Paul Robeson was a modern Renaissance man whose politics and passions made him a subject of controversy for much of his life. His life is the subject of a new biography by Martin Baumel Duberman. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
Paul Robeson just wouldn't hush up. Never mind that he did all right by himself for the grandson of a slave, went to Rutgers on a scholarship and made All-American in football, went to law school at Columbia and picked up a couple of European languages, went to Broadway in a couple of plays by Eugene O'Neill, went to Hollywood and sang Old Man River in Showboat, went to England where they let him do Othello, went to Russia and got uppity, couldn't go anywhere when we took away his passport, and so went crazy from the sadness and the electroshock. This Robeson, when he wasn't singing spirituals at benefits for his disenfranchised people, or for labor unions, or for Progressive Party candidates for president, when he wasn't going to bed with white women like Peggy Ashcroft before she became a dame, and Uta Hagen while she was still married to Jose Ferrer, when he couldn't, because of his skin color, get a room in a hotel or a table at a restaurant or a concert hall to sing in like an angel in cities like New York and Seattle and Los Angeles, this black Captain Marvel, who ought to have been grateful that white Americans liked him more than they liked most other black folks, insisted instead on complaining about racism and colonialism and imperialism and red baiting. Roy Wilkins of the NAACP didn't like Robeson any better than J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI liked Robeson, any more than either of them later on would like Martin Luther King Jr., who was very different, but just as uppity. So what our government couldn't do to him, the doctors did. They cured his depression by electroconvulsive therapy. They seized his brain. He didn't die until 1976, but he'd been more or less missing for at least a decade before that. Martin Baumel Duberman, a prize-winning biographer and playwright, will tell us everything that Robeson ever said or did, and everything that was ever said or done to him, wherever he went, from Princeton to Paris to Moscow to Prague. A painstaking Duberman paints us a picture that includes the Stalinism and the womanizing, the willfulness and craziness. But we are also always looking at a portrait of someone heroic, someone who discarded his advantages for his convictions, who abused brain and body on behalf of a people not half so blessed. Why did he sink into depression, even as he was free again to travel? Reluctant to psychologize, Duberman nevertheless suggests an emotional breakdown as a consequence of, quote, accumulated denial, a denial not only of the ugly reality of Stalinism, but of the ugliness of human nature itself. He was, in a way, a victim of his own faith in an impossible kind of, quote, revolutionary purity. Too cautiously, Duberman then beats a hasty retreat from this shadow realm of speculation, back again into the safety of letters and clippings, a gray world of disconsolate facts, a history of waste. Paul Robeson is a very long book. It could have been longer. Robeson's wife, Essie, an odd combination of Harriet Mill and Mother Courage, deserves a volume to herself, and it should have been angrier, if only to uncoil some dramatic lunge, some avenging shape. But what it is, patient, scholarly, exhaustive, is enough to dream on and to infuriate.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday and media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed a new biography of Paul Robeson by Martin Baumel Duberman.
Old man River, that old man River, he must know something, but don't say nothing. He just keeps rolling, he keeps on rolling along. He don't plant taters, and them that plants are me soon forgotten.
Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, Girls Gone Bad, thrill-crazy delinquents, and the corrupting influence of rock and roll. Michael Barson tells us about his new book, Lost, Lonely, and Vicious. It's a collection of movie posters from what he describes as the great trash films of the 50s. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the debut album from Marimelin, a marimba and violin duet that plays music running the gamut from classical to jazz to Latin. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone tells us what she thinks of Whoopi Goldberg's latest live show. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Bergen directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.